You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the studio, radio studios of Radio Maria here in Toronto, presenting a broadcast today for the program Ask the Lawyer. It's going to be based today also on immigration and citizenship matters. Before we start with our presentation, we want to remind you that we welcome comments and questions on our theme from any of you listeners. You shouldn't hesitate or feel nervous about calling. No comment is too silly or unimportant. To encourage some communication and conversation that's of benefit to all the people listening today. And our phone-in number for questions to be asked that'll be area code 416 here in Toronto. And the phone number is 245-1534. Again, area code 416-245-1534. The program today, I'm going to deal with a number of matters relating to immigration and citizenship. It's always a hot-button item, and it's becoming even more of a hot-button item with the impending elections. What they call the midterm elections in the United States, and what happens from a legal perspective, not only in the United States, but here in Canada, with matters relating to immigration. The late Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau once remarked that when the elephant rolls in bed, the mouse has to head for cover. And in a way, he was talking essentially about economic, but basically all of our relationship in North America with respect to the United States and Canada. When the United States does certain things that has not only an impact worldwide, it has a particular impact here in North America. And in that context, from our last broadcast, we were in the midst of the North American Free Trade Agreement being renegotiated between Canada, the United States, and also Mexico, which is also renegotiated or being updated, depending on one's point of view, that has now seemingly brought together an agreement between the three countries moving forward, although it still remains to be ratified by the various governments. In Mexico, we have a new government, what they would call a center-left government, Prime Minister Obrador, who's taking over from Prime Minister Nieto, was considered more of a center-right candidate in Mexican politics, but who also was a supporter of the continuation of an agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. So we expect that will proceed, subject to some wrinkles relating to tariffs caused by the Trump administration in the United States, and similarly with Canada, with the deal that's being negotiated and discussed a lot in the papers. And these issues are all very important to us on a day-by-day basis, of course, and the legal part of these things are not just an abstract principle. They have very tangible, direct results in everything that we are involved with in our lives here in Toronto. We have, as you know, a city, a greater metropolis of around 6.5 million people. We have just surpassed Chicago as in North America as an important metropolis. So leaving aside Mexico City, which must be in the 20 million range by now. The major cities are New York, Los Angeles, followed by Toronto now that has surpassed Chicago. So we can expect the things that happen in North America, particularly for those here in the Toronto area, to have a huge impact. And of course, they do. So all of these business matters and personal matters reflect themselves in the law and the various levels of law that we have. So I mentioned we have the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is going to have another acronym, but it will essentially, we could call it the new NAFTA. And a lot of people were wondering, because Canada was actually very much in the forefront of trying to renegotiate a whole bunch of areas, renegotiate or update, because the agreement was 25 years old. You can imagine 25 years ago, the internet was not even as well established as it is today. So you can imagine, just by a simple example of that, how things were going to proceed. And of course, in the North American Free Trade Agreement, there were a number of issues that were designed to, in fact, make less bureaucratic the immigration processes that exist in all of our countries. As I've mentioned before, we are roughly admitting about 350,000 people a year into Canada, and about 125,000 of those people are going to the Greater Toronto Area. And of course, those of us who live in the Toronto area see the cranes in the sky, and they're not likely to stop any point soon. We also had the elections here in Toronto where Mayor John Tory was reelected, and a much reduced municipal council with a smaller number of councillors will be deciding things that are very important, like transit policy, which is important. Some of you may wonder, what the heck does transit policy have to do with immigration? It actually has a lot to do with immigration, because if people are coming into the Greater Toronto Area in the numbers of 125,000 people a year, these people have to go live and work somewhere. And so we know that will create pressure in terms of traffic and will require, of course, a lot more public transit, namely subway lines, light rapid transit, if you wish to call that, tram lines, and all the various projects that are necessary for a modern city to function. So they're actually very intricately linked. So with the North American Free Trade Agreement, the new NAFTA, I'll call it, because the acronym has not been completely agreed upon, one of the things that is not changing very much, and it's perhaps of great importance to those of us who are listening in the English language broadcast, is that there's actually not a big change that we can see so far, if any, relating to who can come work in Canada or which Canadians can go work in the United States and Mexico. The North American Free Trade Agreement tries, as I said, to try to make the bureaucratic processes a little bit less bureaucratic. Well, maybe a lot more a lot less bureaucratic. So, for example, I'll take a simple example. Let's say I'll use myself. I'm a lawyer. I'm here in Toronto, and let's say that there's a law firm in Chicago that, for whatever reason, wants to hire me to provide advice to the clients in their Chicago law office, probably relating to matters in Ontario, and they want to hire me to come work in Chicago. Now, you can imagine my area of expertise would not be American law, it would be Canadian, or in particular Ontario law. So if they gave me a job offer and I presented myself at the port of entry in the United States with my original law degree and my qualifications, my resume, a proper job offer from the law firm in Chicago, I would be able to get a work visa anywhere from a minimum of one, maybe up to 3 years, to be able to work in Chicago legally and to provide the services that I would provide for the American clients. And that would be acceptable. And I just use that as an example, because it's true for people who are engineers, architects, physiotherapists, dentists. They tend to be professions. So there's a pretty decent mobility of labor between the professions that are listed in the schedule to the NAFTA to going in particular. I'll emphasize Canada and the United States. It also exists for Mexico, but in particular for Canada and the United States, so that people can freely, fairly freely enter with, of course, the proper safeguards and that are involved either coming into Canada or coming into the United States. So all of those procedures have not changed in principle, and that may be seen as a big negative of this new agreement, because it was felt that both for Canadian and American purposes, maybe those kinds of professions should not only should be expanded, but maybe things should be made even more simple in terms of what's required in order to present yourself at a port of entry to get what is essentially a work permit to work in that country. In fact, although there were all kinds of negotiations going on, we as lawyers were looking at what might be improved, especially in the area of tremendous growth in our economy, namely industries related to technology and artificial intelligence and engineering and so on. At the end of the day, there really wasn't much change, which leads one to think, because Canada was interested in, and Canada is interested in, a much more open, freer labor and trading dynamic than is the United States under the current American presidency of Trump, that in fact there's not been this change, and so it's maybe something that in particular the American government was not interested in doing. And that, of course, relates to what we would call either a nationalist or a protectionist agenda. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, we are seeing various examples of a nationalist slash protectionist environment that is occurring within the United States, where people are thinking, and it may be a bit of an anachronism, because, you know, on the one hand, we see these things that are impediments to the flow of labor and capital into the United States. On the other hand, we have the lowest unemployment rate in the United States in the past, I don't know, 60 years or so. It's like below 4%, which even if you adjusted the American definition of unemployment and the Canadian, is not exactly the same. So if you see an American rate of about 4%, it's probably more like our 5%. But if it's 3.5% in the United States, it's like 4.5%, which modern economists would say is almost 0%. So we seem to have, both in Canada and the United States, fairly active economies that need qualified people to come and work and do the things that we deem necessary in this country. And on the other hand, at a very strong political level, you know, the Americans almost 2 years ago elected President Trump on a much more, I would call it, nationalist or protectionist agenda. And there's elections coming up in November, which we'll see in the House of Representatives and in the American Senate, whether or not that balance of power, which is held by the Republican Party, will continue or not. And this becomes very important because, as in all political systems, especially in the United States, there is, it's not, and people sometimes have this idea that President Trump is like, you know, is like a great dictator, that he can just do whatever he wants. This is not true. In the American system, as in Canada, there are checks and balances, and the American House of Representatives and the Senate is a check and balance on the powers of a president, as is the American judiciary. And, of course, we've just seen recently the great kerfuffle relating to how justices of the Supreme Court of the United States are approved by a Senate committee on the nomination of the existing president. And we've seen all of those issues that have come out and have engendered not only a lot of discussion, a lot of heated discussion, and unfortunately recently, this past week, we've seen a number of mail bombs that were delivered to people like former President Clinton, to the former President Obama, to a number of people in particular who are Democrats, by someone who we discovered this morning happens to be a great admirer of Trump. Not that he is necessarily supported by Trump in his activities. As a matter of fact, I would say he would not be. But he's an ex bodybuilder, an ex stripper, and now a Republican candidate who thinks it's quite all right to send mail bombs to people. So the rhetoric and the great to and fro of politics is under a lot of discussion, and we all have to ask ourselves a lot of serious questions about how far, not only how far do politicians go, but how far we as citizens allow politicians to go. Because, we seem to think that we externalize all these issues. It's those guys out there who are doing it, all this. But they're really just a reflection of ourselves, I would suggest to you. So we have to think about when we start talking in a, what I would call, in a very un-Christian way towards people, what are we really trying to achieve? Are we trying just to get upset? Are we maybe encouraging kooks to incite violence against either people? So we have a responsibility to maybe tone down the rhetoric. We can all have different ideas, and we can probably discuss them civilly. We can even discuss them passionately. But there's always a question in philosophy, is the line in the sand. And where do you cross over into the line in the sand? And this is essentially what's reflected, in our legal system. People don't realize it, but it is. So here we have all these events that have been occurring in this past month that are coming to a head, and they're all interrelated. And and to top it all off, not only with the North American Free Trade Agreement or the new NAFTA and the midterm elections, what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is there's supposedly a caravan of people arriving from Central American countries who want to go through Mexico to be able to go to the U.S. to make a claim for what they call asylum, or what we would call a refugee application, which again is a great is absolutely an incredible and great story in terms of timing with the American elections and what is going on everywhere in the world, in particular with relationship to refugee law and the movement of refugees. We've talked in our other programs about the Rohingya Muslim minority in Myanmar, who've been basically shipped across the border, and the great problems. Here, we've seen in the last 2 years a number of people present themselves at the Canadian border to be processed as refugees because they fear that the American system is not going to be doing its job. And these are not things that happen in a vacuum. So I wanted to, because this caravan of people struck me as particularly important, because people are making, and in particular, it's quite clear that President Trump thinks this is unacceptable and he wants to close the borders, which is, what he wanted to do with erecting a wall between Mexico and the United States. So all these very highly emotional topics are being presented and are being, some people would say, discussed or not being discussed, perhaps. And it's very important to understand for us here in Canada that this all has a direct impact on us. So you're going to say, Joe, what are you talking about? What is all these guys showing up in Mexico have to do, or coming from Guatemala or El Salvador, going to Mexico? What the heck's that got to do with us here? That's thousands of kilometers away, and doesn't have anything to do with us. But indeed, it has a lot to do with us. And it has a lot to do with us because in the context of immigration, we also have a security agreement between the United States and Canada. And what people have forgotten about is that this security agreement, which arose out of the 9/11 in 2001, a mere 17 years ago, arose out of a concern in the United States relating to terrorists and security and people causing harm to people inside of our countries. And even though there was a great deal of analysis relating to the terrorists who were involved in the 9/11 tragedy, in fact, having been legally admitted to the United States, in particular through legal means, especially as students, and especially from countries that were considered friends of the United States, like Saudi Arabia. Nonetheless, there was a great push to try to keep what we would call the bad people out of our respective countries. In Canada, like it was with the Free Trade Agreement and the North American Free Trade Agreement, was brought in and was and has become part of a security agreement within North America. And one of the terms of that agreement is that when somebody would show up at their border, that country had the obligation to determine whether or not that person was a refugee, or what in the United States they call it, an asylum seeker. Now, you may say to me, okay, well, that seems like a fair deal for Canada, because who is going to arrive in Canada except by plane and perhaps by boat, coming from either across the Bering Strait, from Russia or over the North Pole. And so the people that come into Canada, even though they would like to perhaps go to the United States, they would be obliged to file a refugee claim here in Canada. And I have to always remind people that these refugee claims don't exist within a vacuum. There is an international definition agreed upon by the United Nations, to which Canada and the U.S. adhere, as to who is a refugee. A person is a refugee who has to have a well-founded fear of persecution for race, religion, and a number of other areas relating essentially to human rights. And what people have to also understand is that people do not have a right to come to another country because they are, quote-unquote, economic refugees. Economic refugees are not refugees, as we understand it in the international law context and within the security agreement that exists between Canada and the United States. So just because you and I would have a cousin in Italy would like to come to Canada to live because times are tough in Italy and they can't find work, that's too bad. That's the way the system works. And we're not being cruel, but we admit, as I said before, 350,000 people a year. We choose who we want to come to Canada. And of that 350,000, probably not more than 20 to 35,000 people a year are refugees, half of which are processed with the assistance of the United Nations and are privately sponsored by groups who promise and do financially take care of people for the first year, which is, of course, the toughest time to try to get them jobs, apartments, and get them well settled in Canada. So we have a system where, once again, in the news, you have, it seems like, you know, when you listen to whatever you want to call it, CNN, the Fox Network, President Trump, the CBC, whatever you want to call it, we see, they talk about the caravan of people arriving from Central America. Well, there might be a few thousand people, but relative, certainly from a Canadian perspective, it's not a huge number. And we shouldn't even think about the United States because that's a tenfold number. But it creates a lot of pressure on politicians to react on something, although the numbers themselves are actually not that great. Now, in Canada, where this security agreement with Canada and the U.S. is very important, and I want to emphasize this because this is where there's a lot of discussion happening inside of Canada as to this agreement. First of all, with the election of President Trump, a lot of people more on the left are saying, well, you know, we can't trust the situation, and are they going to treat people fairly, and so on and so forth. There's a great debate going on in this country about whether the security agreement should exist or not, or how it should exist. But as it exists right now, a person who arrives has to it's called the Safe Third Country Agreement. And as I said, it has as its core principle that people seeking refugee protection have to file their claim in the first safe country they arrive in, unless they qualify for a few exemptions, which are largely related to humanitarian and family issues. And the other core tenet in this agreement is that Canada considers the United States a safe country for refugees. So if an asylum seeker comes to Canada at an official border crossing from the U.S. and tries to claim refugee protection, we here in Canada will refuse them entry, encourage them to make their claim in the U.S., the safe country, that's what they're called, the United States is a safe country from which they just came. And that is also true if somebody on the opposite side, somebody wishes to do the same thing, coming into the U.S. The U.S. would say, no, you can't make this application. Canada is a safe country. On this agreement, you have to continue with your refugee claim in Canada because we have a rule of law that determines how people are going to be treated as refugees. And the requirements for designating a country as safe is a threefold test. Each country has to comply with the United Nations Convention Against Torture and the United Nations Convention on Refugees, and it has to maintain a good human rights record. Now, this is very, very important from a legal perspective because traditionally, Canada and the U.S. in particular have been countries that have really tried to comply and have had laws that comply with the United Nations Convention Against Torture. We don't want people come into the country who have committed torture somewhere else in the world. And we know that that occurs. It occurs in Iran. It occurs in Russia, unfortunately. And it occurs in a lot of countries where, unfortunately, absolute power is vested in a very small number of people. And the second part, again, is that they must respect and comply with the United Nations Convention on Refugees, the UN Convention on Refugees, which, once again, Canada and the United States adhere to, and we must maintain good human rights records. And notwithstanding all the politics and everything else we see, in fact, the United States has a history, even within the last 2 years, notwithstanding the political grandstanding, of in fact belonging to and adhering to these essential tenets. We have not heard the United States say that they're not going to be part of the United Nations Convention on Refugees. And so we have to take things at their words. And some of you might say, well, I've been reading in the newspapers that this past summer that the American administration decided that spousal abuse and minority sexual preferences were not going to be seen in the same light in the United States. And there's discussion about that here. But essentially, it doesn't take away from the main and the clear principles espoused under the Safe Third Party Agreement. Where there's great discussion for us here in Canada about the Safe Third Party Agreement, and that we've seen is that all these people this past winter coming across at the borders in places like Manitoba, and people may have been scratching their heads and said, wait a minute, don't we have this agreement with the United States that if you are in the United States and you've made an application for refugee status, that that's where you make it? Like, what are all these people doing making applications in Canada? And so the great political discussion and the legal discussion that is going on right now in Canada is, in fact, our own law relating to that Safe Third Party Agreement, because, unfortunately, that Third Party Agreement maybe has a big gap or what lawyers refer to as a lacuna in the law, in that they're supposed to be making this application at a port of entry. And a port of entry, what is a port of entry? A port of entry is a place like Buffalo, Niagara Falls, Gananoque, Windsor, Detroit, Sarnia. Those are ports of entry. You know, when we go into the United States, for example, guy stops us, says where we're going, what are we doing, how long are we going to be gone. Those are official ports of entry. So a lot of these people were entering, and what we saw in the news over the winter, they were not at official ports of entry. They, because as we know, between Canada and the United States, we have the longest unprotected border in the world. So if you literally could cross the fields of North Dakota, you could go into, if my geography's right, you could go into Manitoba, and you would probably be able to find an RCMP station, but it's not an official port of entry. And so a lot of the people in the United States who felt particularly threatened by the change in the Trump administration and the negative aspects being portrayed in a lot of the media about refugees, were afraid that they would not be able to remain in the United States, some of whom have been there for many, many years, and they feel that Canada will be more than a safe haven. Now, all those of us here in Canada can be particularly disturbed by this lacuna, this hole in the legislation, and we may be wondering why it is that we're not taking steps to close that loophole, to make it, well, it's a matter of great discussion whether or not that loophole is going to be closed, but everything relating to laws and immigration and citizenship take a long time. And I would remind people that even when the present government, led by Justin Trudeau, were elected, they had promised all kinds of changes in the citizenship law that we as lawyers thought were actually quite simple and simple to implement. Well, it took them about 2.5 years to do it. So you can imagine something like this, which is really a hot-button topic, again, whether or not that loophole should be closed so that the safe third country agreement exists no matter where you cross the United States, is a matter of great discussion. And, of course, the other thing that people forget about is it's not for Canada to decide that this safe third country agreement is going to be changed. We don't have a unilateral right to change it. The United States does not have a unilateral right to change it. So this agreement, if it's going to be changed, it's going to be changed when Canada and the United States both agree to change it. Because technically somebody could enter at a non-port of entry from Canada to the United States and make an application that's not covered by the safe third party country agreement. So with some of these very technical and, you know, precise issues that I've been pointing out to you, you can see that what's presented in the newspapers or on television or in the media has to be carefully understood from the legal context that is that is in the background. Now, to top it all off, in this past week, as after the American elections and the people, and particularly last winter, who are trying to get into Canada, a big discussion is resulted out of, okay, well, all these people who started coming in last year, what's been happening to them? Have they all been admitted into Canada as refugees? And the answer is a resounding no. I think the statistics are like over 90% of them have not been accepted as refugees. And so what a lot of the Canadian immigration officials are encouraging these people to do is, in fact, that they return to the United States where they can continue with their asylum claim. So all of you may say, well, my goodness, that puts them in, it makes it very difficult for them. It does make it a bit difficult. But Canada has not been so generous. We've been applying the laws as they expect that they should be applied. And so it may be that it's much ado about nothing. Canada, in fact, has recently announced that they've already removed 6 of the 900 asylum seekers that were already facing U.S. deportation. So it's this background of this caravan of people, as you can appreciate, is a great hot button topic, although it really does not represent an awful lot of people. And of course, the United States has taken no steps to address the number of illegal people living inside of the United States. And we must admit that in Canada, it is the same. We have a large number of people who are living inside of Canada. Our immigration policy is much less generous than it was 10, 15 years ago. In Canada, 10 or 15 years ago, we had something called, and we still do have it legally, called the Humanitarian Compassionate Grounds for admitting people to Canada, where very often people who are here without status for at least 5 and perhaps 10 years, if they in fact had worked and had not been involved in criminal activity, that we were compassionate and humanitarian enough to allow them to become landed immigrants in Canada. And that was a much more generous policy than what existed in the United States. But that policy, in fact, has changed radically. The implementation of humanitarian and compassionate grounds has been severely reduced. And I hope one day to be able to share this particular aspect of the law with you and have some lawyers who are involved on a panel who can discuss, what really happens? What do those words humanitarian and compassionate mean in the present context? But there are not hordes of people arriving, and in fact we're not very generous in this law. But in any event, there is a study that was released this past week, which Canada wanted to see whether or not they should in fact be terminating the Safe Third Party Country Agreement as a result of the political pronouncements, in particular of President Donald Trump, and what was happening in the U.S. This was particularly the case because the President Trump had issued a number of executive orders in immigration, trying to beef up border security to end the abuse of parole and asylum provisions that delay and complicate the removal of undocumented migrants to the U.S. And so Canada wanted to really look at it internally, whether or not Canada was continuing to meet the requirements for designation as a safe third country. And I won't bore you with all the details, but the conclusion was that notwithstanding whatever we might see in the press and so on and hear of in general, Canada was continuing, the United States basically was still a safe third country. And the measures that were being taken under the U.S., maybe tighten up border controls and so on, doesn't really denigrate from the true legal situation relating to the determination of refugees. And the immigration department said that they had carefully analyzed the recent developments in the United States, including the executive orders related to immigration and refugee matters, and they continue to consider the United States a safe country for asylum claimants to seek protection there. And it's a subject of ongoing discussion. So you see that the Safe Country Agreements, it's probably going to remain, but this internal memo and conclusion did say that, and what I just mentioned to you before, that the big loophole and the key culprit in people being upset about things is that the agreement only applies at official border points, which creates an incentive for migrants to cross the border illegally between ports of entry. So this is where you're going to see a lot of discussion in the next year, because we've gone through elections here in Ontario, which once again is probably a more of a populist bent in the election of Premier Ford in Ontario. We can expect more of a populist bent based on what's been said and what's being done. We shouldn't be surprised at that. There seems to be a great populist / nationalist resentment everywhere in the world, not just in the United States or Ontario. This weekend, there are elections in Brazil where what I would call an more extreme right-wing nationalist populist bent is maybe elected. In Brazil, which is the fifth largest country in the world, as the president of Brazil. We see great discussions in Europe And I'll mention in particular Italy, from where I just returned for 2 weeks. We have a populist slash nationalist government in Italy, composed of two key political players, Salvini and Di Maio, who are not adhering to the principles of the European Union. They're challenging them. And so we're going to see something happen on that on a worldwide scale, and I'll turn to back to that in a second. But the point is that in the Canadian, we see this these winds blowing, these political winds blowing, which have an impact, and you have to understand them in the context of the legal agreement. And so in the safe third-party agreement, which is has this big loophole, in 2017, Canada intercepted 21,000 migrants who crossed illegally into Canada at the Canadian-U.S. land border. And the trend continues in 2008, this report said, and it continues to be a significant concern for the integrity of our shared border. So it's in a problem, but it is 21,000 people, so it's something that's going to happen. And in that context, we can see that these are the kinds of things. If you look at them in the context of people fleeing Central America into Mexico and what I just described before, and what I mentioned even in Europe, because in Italy, as many of you may once again read in the papers or know, is that large numbers of people are arriving, especially in Italy, which is probably the closest border attraction from Africa. From all over the world, there are people arriving seeking a better life for themselves, but they're not actually seeking to remain in Italy, because Italy has huge financial problems. It has huge public debt issues. It's the second most indebted European country after Greece, and as all of you know, Greece essentially went into bankruptcy and receivership under the aegis of the European Union over 10 years ago, and it's and a lot of the people have suffered. And so Italy, even though it's a very industrialized and developed country, has this huge public debt issue that is not going away. So there's actually not a lot of work per se available. And we see massive numbers of people, especially younger people, looking to leave Italy for a better life for themselves. So you have all these people who are, admittedly are of color in particular, and a lot of whom are perhaps even fleeing persecution from Muslim countries, looking to arrive in Italy, but they don't want to stay in Italy. They want to use Italy as a point to go, usually to family and friends that they have, where? In places where there's a lot more work, England, Germany, France, Holland, and so on and so forth. So we see this is a worldwide problem. It's not just a Canadian problem or an issue. And the European Union issue is important to understand because those of us here who have a link to Europe would think, well, all these people are going to arrive and stay in Italy, and which is not true. Maybe 10% will stay, but 90% want to move on. But the European rules are a little bit different. So if I arrive in Italy, although Italy is supposed to take care of their asylum claim, a lot of times they don't make the formal asylum claim until they go into a country like Germany, which, believe it or not, has a much more flexible or liberal approach traditionally to refugee or asylum claimants than a country like Italy's had, which has not been actually very generous, and which adheres, of course, to the UN Convention. Once again, a refugee or an asylum seeker is not an economic refugee. Economics are not the issue, because otherwise the whole world would be an open border and people could live wherever they want to live. And that socially would just not be acceptable. So we see that notwithstanding the demographics that exist in Italy, where they could perhaps accept more people, the big question in Italy is we want to be able to choose who comes and lives in Italy, aside from European nationals who have a right to come legally from, let's say, Bulgaria and to work legally in Italy and do whatever and be paid properly and pay their taxes and do whatever. And that, of course, happens in Italy to a great extent. The the northeast of Italy, where my family comes from, in the Veneto in particular, the northeast is as was traditionally a great magnet for many people who came from Romania in particular, and even Albania, but more Romania. And people don't realize that the largest immigrant group in Italy are the Romanians. There must be about 800,000 of them now living in Italy. But of course, they're not of color, so they meld in a little bit more easily. The second largest group are the North Africans, and if I'm not mistaken, the Senegalese in particular, the Tunisians in particular, who do a lot of skilled work in factories and so on, of color, but they live and they work there, and the kids all go to school. And I must admit, I haven't seen the big problems, notwithstanding the headlines. But you see, people are concerned when they see people arrive at their border points because they're afraid there are criminals, there are terrorists, there are all kinds of issues that are occurring, and it really disturbs people's sensibilities. But the legal situation, which maybe can be criticized, is that maybe the law should move more quickly than what it does to determine if people are or not refugees. And in that point, I must tell you that the former government of Prime Minister Harper, in fact, did that. He did appoint a large number what we would call refugee determination people or refugee judges. They're not really judges, but they're people who have a certain ability and to make decisions based on the UN Convention and Canadian case law to determine if somebody was a refugee or not. And so what we did many years ago, or what he did in particular, his government, was they devoted a lot more resources and people to make those determinations. Now, I can remember 20 years ago, I would have clients who would come into my office from countries like, I'll use Hungary as an example. It could be any country, but this always struck me because I had a Hungarian gentleman who, in fact, had come from the United States where he had done specialty construction work. And he came to Canada and he said to me, Mr. Martinello, and he spoke English quite well because he was in the States for a few years and then had to leave, and he was here with his wife and his two kids. And he said, Mr. Martinello, how long will it take for me to process my refugee claim? And I said, well, about 7 years. He said, that's wonderful. And so as odd as it seems, that's how slow the process was. And those 7 years, believe it or not, he worked legally here. He paid his taxes. He, in fact, even started his own construction company. He made a lot of money. He sent a lot of money back to Hungary where he was well-established. And when his claim was eventually refused, he left Canada and he went back to Hungary to live. And the Canadian system was not very generous to him in terms, even though he had established himself. And you and I might say, well, wait a minute, I don't get it. This is a guy who's a skilled tradesperson who was working here legally making money, and we sent him back to Hungary? And the answer is yes, unfortunately, because that's the way the system was. But today, that situation would be, well, maybe not today. Today, the lineups have gotten a little bit longer. But that's what the Prime Minister Harper's government did. They devoted more time and resources to making decisions. And the backlog went from 7 years to about 1 year, which is not bad in legal terms. So there are solutions, as there are solutions in Italy, for example, those of us who are familiar with the European situation. But you have to devote money and effort to determine whether or not a person is a proper refugee. And that doesn't seem to be a political appetite to do it, maybe because it's expensive, but that's what needs to be done. So as we look at the events that unfold in the next few months with the elections and people talking about refugees in particular and immigration, we have to remember that that immigration in Canada, about 90% of it is for people that we decide will come to Canada. And we have a system that works quite well that way, and we continue to do that. And in fact, Canada continues to be a magnet as a result for immigration. The United States is too, quite frankly, because people can make good money in the United States if they work hard. And but one of the things that's happened, interestingly, to our benefit, I must say, because of the hardline approach and the politics that's happening in the United States, and the fears that people have, is that people who would otherwise have been attracted to the United States are now considering Canada. And we have seen in countries, and very, I must tell you, very, very well educated and I think very motivated people, a lot of whom even have done postgraduate degrees in England, in Canada, United States, and Ireland, who may not want to return, for example, to a country like India, which is still really a third world country, to make a better life for themselves, and would be normally have been very attracted to the United States. And Canada is being very, very aggressive in my hometown, Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge area. They're increasingly aggressive in terms of establishing a real pocket of technological artificial intelligence and quantum physics institutes that are attracting very intelligent people for jobs. So just this past week, another article was published which said there's a rising number of job seekers from India who are certainly looking for work opportunities in Canada over the United States, and with searches for tech jobs leading the way. So the number of job searches conducted from India for Canada have jumped from 6 to 13% in 2 years. So, and the number of people looking for employment opportunities in the United States has dropped from 60 to 50%, with Canada picking up the displaced interest. That is basically a net 17% narrowing of search popularity. It's the largest we've ever seen. And these, and so we're looking at all this data, and so it really does appear that Canada is becoming more of a hub for the industries that are going to be most important in the next few years relating to technology in particular. So jobs like business analysts, software developers, web developers, data scientists, Java developers, software engineers, these are all jobs that are high, high in demand. Civil engineers, you talk with any of your engineering friends, you'll see that, that there's a huge demand. Project managers. So this rise is due to the Canadian booming tech sector and the uncertainty about the US H-1B program, which used to be very generous, is no longer generous. So anybody who is English or French speaking, and we must remember that Montreal has a huge technology development sector, especially in certain specialized areas. And so we're finding that Canada is indirectly a huge beneficiary of what's happening in the United States. So as the elephant turns, the mouse squirms, and sometimes we run from cover, or maybe we don't get squashed at the end of the day, and we live to tell our story for another day. So on that happy note, I would just tell you, whatever you watch in the papers and the news, think about it, about how the legal context in the background and some of these things that we talked about, which is the reality as opposed to the news or the fake news, how that's all going to play with each other. You'll probably find the stories a lot more interesting, and you'll be able to appreciate how, in our day-to-day lives, how and why we see the people who are around us who've come from other countries working and or seeking to come to Canada to live and work here. And on that note, I'm going to pass the microphone back to Nick in our studio, and we hope you have a great weekend.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.